So unfortunately, it was halfway through the sutta, and most of you weren't here for the first half, so you're going to have to figure it out as we go along. But I'll give you a quick reminder of what's happening. This sutta is one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is about, basically, it's an autobiographical account of the Buddha, of his own life before he was enlightened, and how he actually came about to attain enlightenment, and also shortly a little bit about the things that happened just after his enlightenment, or awakening, if you like. I actually prefer the word awakening to enlightenment. I feel it's more meaningful. So this is what this is about. And I mentioned last time that the good thing about understanding the biography of the Buddha is that you get closer to the Buddha if you understand what he was all about. You see actually what sort of person he was. You come to understand him. And just like other people in our life that we are close to, the reason that we are close to somebody is because we have some personal knowledge about that person. We know their history, their background, we know who they are, we know how they think to a certain extent. And that is what brings you close to somebody. And the same thing with the Buddha, to understand how he was thinking and to see that he was a human being just like us. It gives us a sense of connection to the Buddha himself. And the second reason why it is useful to understand the life of the Buddha, particularly before his enlightenment, is because it shows you basically the path to awakening, how it's done, and how it was done by the Buddha himself. So it's like a teaching, in a sense, in the Eightfold Path, because the path that the Buddha treaded to become enlightened or awakened is the same path, basically, that we also have to walk ourselves. So for these reasons, it can be quite inspiring. As I pointed out in the previous installment of the sutta, or the first installment, the Buddha's motivation for going forth was because he realized the suffering of life, he realized the problems of old age, illness, death, and also things like defilements. And because of that, it was that motivation, seeing his own suffering, seeing the suffering of life, that actually made the Buddha go forth and become a monk, and try to find a solution to the problem that the suffering of life. And it's not sometimes when you read later histories, later biographies of the Buddha, they always talk about the Buddha being like a bodhisattva, somebody who's there to solve the problems of all humanity and of all other beings. But if you read what the Buddha himself said, is that he says, I see suffering in my life, I want to find a solution to that suffering. There's nothing there about trying to solve other people's problems, about solving his own problems, first of all. And it makes very good sense, because before you can help other people, you actually have to find a solution to the problem, right? So first of all, you find a solution, and then you can think about helping other people afterwards. This idea of, you know, helping other people first is a bit, to me, it doesn't make such good sense, because you haven't actually, you don't even know if there is a solution in the first place. So then the Buddha went forth in search of a solution to the problem of suffering, and then he found that solution. He was able to discover the end of suffering in the world, and of course that is Nibbana. It's all explained very briefly in this particular sutta. It's not very expanded. There are other suttas which fill in some of the gaps. If you're interested in reading those suttas, one of the most important ones is Majjhima number 36, 10 suttas after this one. You can read that one if you like for yourself, and that sort of fills in many of the gaps that this particular sutta leaves out. There are also a number of other suttas which sort of fill in some more of the gaps, but I can't remember exactly what they are at the moment. So now we come to where I stopped last time, and if you have the page numbers of the Majjhima Nikaya, we are on halfway down page 260. I stopped just where he says, the first paragraph there, where he says, the knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. In other words, he has discovered the end of rebirth. The end of rebirth is the end of suffering. And then the Buddha continues. I considered this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. So here we have the Buddha's first thoughts after his enlightenment. And he obviously, for the first time, he understands how profound this Dhamma that he has discovered actually is. And that it's not easy for other people to understand this Dhamma. Specifically, he says here that this generation delights in worldliness. This generation just means these people at this particular point in time. It means any people, really, because it's always pretty much the same. And delighting in worldliness, worldliness here, this word is alaya in Pali. And alaya means like, it almost means like nesting. The root meaning of this word is like nesting, or having like a bird having a nest, having your nest kind of thing. So you can see how that word then becomes transferred into meaning attachment and craving. Because where you have your nest, where you have your nesting place, where you have your house, your home, that is where you have your attachments and where you have your craving. But to understand this word, you can, one of the usages of this word alaya is in the Himalayas. That's Hima Alaya. And Hima is snow in Pali. And alaya is like the lying or the nesting or the resting of the snow. So the resting of the place where the snow rests, quite literally, is the Himalayas. So that is essentially the meaning here of this word. So this generation delights in this kind of nesting, the having a house, having possessions, having attachments, having cravings. That is essentially the meaning of this word here. And it is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. And of course, dependent origination here, this is the standard 12-link formula that you know, which starts off with ignorance and ends up with suffering, with death, old age, and suffering. So this is what is meant here by dependent origination. And very briefly, to give you, just to very succinctly say what the meaning of dependent origination actually is. Dependent origination, the purpose of this teaching is to show how delusion, ignorance, the first factor of the 12 links, how that ends up becoming suffering in the 12th link. In other words, if you have delusion, if you have ignorance as a starting point, then you are bound to suffer as a consequence. Ignorance always leads to suffering. And this is essentially the meaning of dependent origination. It shows you the process by which ignorance always must lead to suffering. And one of the important factors in between there is rebirth. You have birth is the second last factor. So it is how ignorance, delusion become suffering by way of rebirth, through rebirth. Rebirth is the factor which is the an important link in between there. So that very briefly is what dependent origination shows. And he's saying here it's difficult for people to understand this. He also calls it here specific conditionality. And specific conditionality just means that this sequence of 12 links, each link has a specific cause which is necessary. And if that cause isn't there, then the result doesn't actually arise. So of course, if you have to have old age and death, you have to have birth, first of all. Birth is a specific cause that is required for old age and death. Without birth, there cannot be any old age and death. And for the whole sequence, it is like that. If the previous factor is missing, the subsequent factor cannot exist. If the previous factor is there, the subsequent factor must exist. That is why it goes through the whole formula, with the exception of the link between feeling and craving. It is possible to feel without craving. So that is the only place where the preceding link is not necessarily does not necessarily result in the subsequent link existing here. Apart from that, they all follow each other. That is what is meant here by specific conditionality. There's a specific cause for every effect, and there's a specific effect for every cause going through the 12 links. And then he says, so it's hard to see this dependent origination. It is also hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Now, this particular statement can be understood in two different ways. It can be understood either in the sense as nibbana in this life, the nibbana of becoming an arahant, when you destroy all the defilements of the mind, or it can be understood in terms of the nibbana that happens when the arahant dies, when everything becomes still, and the five khandhas cease once and for all. Now, in the first sense, if you understand this as the nibbana that you get when you become an arahant, in that case, the stilling of all formations, the word formations here is sankhara, in that case, it means the stilling of all the volitional activity, all the activities of the mind, all the willing activity of the mind that leads to rebirth in the future, leads to the production of kamma in the future. That is one way of understanding sabbe sankhara samatha, which is the stilling of all formations here. It is the ending of the second factor of dependent origination. When ignorance ceases, then sankhara ceases. And sankhara in this context is the will, the volition of the mind, the activity of the mind, which creates kamma in the future. So you stop that creation of kamma once and for all. Then you have the relinquishing of all acquisitions. Now, acquisitions here basically means anything you own, like any belonging, anything that is yours. So here you are relinquishing everything you own. Now, that includes, of course, all your material possessions. It includes also all your friends, all your attachments to family members, whatever it might be. Everything external is obviously included in this. But it also includes your five aggregates. You relinquish basically the ownership, the belongings, your five aggregates as a belonging. And this is not so much that you... the point here is not so much that you give these things away, that you get rid of them, that you don't have them. The point here is that the mental attitude of ownership disappears. You don't have any perception anymore of owning these things. It is that attachment, which we call ownership, which actually has disappeared. It's a mental thing which has disappeared there. That is what is the main meaning here, of relinquishing of all acquisitions. You don't have a sense of ownership anymore, including the five aggregates, the feelings, perceptions, etc., your own mental states, basically. Then you have the destruction of craving, and the destruction of craving, of course, is what happens when you become fully enlightened. That is what happens. That is basically one of the main meanings of enlightenment, is destroying the craving. Dispassion, this basically just means that you have no more desire. You have desires that can be completely destroyed. It's almost like here a synonym for the destruction of craving. Viraga is the word here. Cessation is again the same thing. It's the cessation of tanha, of craving, that is meant in this particular context when we talk about the arahant attaining nibbana. So this is the cessation of craving which is meant here. And then nibbana. Now, one of the important things to remember about this word nibbana is that sometimes if you just use the word like that, it sounds like it is a state. It sounds like I have attained nibbana. It sounds like it is something tangible. But remember that when a person in India 2,500 years ago heard this word nibbana, what they would have heard was the meaning of this word, because it had a very specific meaning. And the meaning of this word is something like extinguishment or extinction. And what is being extinguished here, what is becoming extinct, are the defilements of the mind with craving and, of course, also any anger and delusion becoming extinct. So the last three terms here, dispassion, cessation, nibbana, are essentially synonyms, and they all mean the stilling, the ending of craving, of desire, extinguishment of these things. So that is one way of understanding the sequence here. And this is the main way. This is the most important way, Because when you see the usage of Nibbana in the suttas, this is the main meaning of Nibbana. The Nibbanaing, the extinguishment of craving. That is what Nibbana usually means. There is also a much rarer usage of Nibbana, and that is when Nibbana means the ending of the five aggregates. In other words, when the Arahant finally has fulfilled his life, has done what he can do to help other beings, when he or she passes away at the end of a life, that is also called Nibbana, sometimes called final Nibbana. And this sequence here can also be understood in that sense. And sometimes the Pali is a little bit ambiguous, and there can be two meanings sometimes to many of these passages. And I would say the secondary meaning of this passage is that it means the Nibbana at the time when the Arahant finally passes away. And you can see here how this can be understood from this. The stilling of all formations, the other meaning of that word, before I said that it means the ending of all craving, the ending of all will and volition, but the stilling of all formations can also mean the becoming peaceful of all the five khandhas. Because the word sankhara, formations or activities, has these two meanings. Either it can mean the will, the volition, the activity of the mind, or it can mean anything which is like conditioned and built up and produced in existence. In other words, basically everything. And this is the second meaning here, is that when you die, all sankharas, all the five khandhas are stilled and become peaceful. Sabbe sankhara samata. The relinquishing of all acquisitions, well, this again can mean the full relinquishment. Of course, the Arahant is alive, he or she still has the five khandhas. It's only when they pass away that the full relinquishment of these acquisitions, belongings, happen. The destruction of craving, any kind of remainder of will, any kind of remainder of movement of the mind, you can call that craving, maybe, but it's not really craving, but it's like just the will doing its job. That happens and disappears also with final Nibbana. And then you have dispassion, cessation, and Nibbana. Well, dispassion has a secondary meaning. Viraga also means fading away. In this case, it's again almost like a synonym of cessation. Something viragas, it means it fades away. And cessation, a synonym for that again. And Nibbana, which means extinguishment, you can see how all that can actually refer to the cessation, the ending, and the extinguishing of the five khandhas, which happens at Parinibbana. So these are the two meanings of this particular phrase, and the first meaning, I think, is by far the more important one, but it also, I think, has this secondary meaning here. Does that make sense to everybody? Very happy with that? Yeah? If you have any questions, please just raise your hand or whatever. So then the Buddha says that, I can teach these things, but judging by the way people are in society, they wouldn't understand me, so there's not much point in going around taking the trouble of teaching people if they can't understand the Dhamma. So, because of that, he sort of decides that he's not going to teach the Dhamma. Thereupon, there came to me spontaneously these stanzas never heard before. Enough with teaching the Dhamma that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate. Those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, deep, subtle, and difficult to see. Considering thus, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. Then bhikkhus, the Brahma Sahampati, knew with his mind the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Sahampati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder and extended his hands in reverential salutation, in Anjali, towards me, and said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. The Brahma Sahampati spoke thus, and then he said further. So before I move on to that, I will just very briefly just comment on a couple of things here. He says here, there are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. What does it mean to have little dust in your eyes? And it means a couple of things. It means, first of all, that your hindrances are quite weak. And because your hindrances are quite weak, it means that your mind is ready to see things as they actually are. It's the hindrances that stop you from seeing things the way they actually are. So there are beings out there who don't have too many hindrances in their minds. And the second thing it means is that you have right view to a certain extent. Because if you are strongly attached to a particular view, say that you believe in a creator God and the soul, or you believe in that the body and the mind are going to be annihilated at death, these two things are the two main views talked about in the suttas called eternalism and annihilationism. If you are very attached to those views and you're not willing to give them up, even in the face of evidence to the contrary, well then of course you're going to be stuck. And that is the other aspect of having much dust in your eyes. So this is my personal interpretation, but I see it as meaning much dust means a lot of hindrances and strong attachment to a particular view, which is considered wrong from the Buddhist perspective. Okay, so then it goes on. The Brahma Sahampati spoke thus, and then he said further, In Magadha there has appeared till now impure teachings devised by those still stained. Open the doors to the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma that the stainless one has found. Just as one who stands on the mountain peak can see below the people all around, so, O wise one, all-seeing sage, ascend the palace of the Dhamma. Let the sorrowless one survey this human breed, engulfed in sorrow, overcome by birth and old age. Arise, victorious hero, caravan leader, deathless one, and wander in the world. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. So here are the verses of this mighty Brahma Sahampati, this great deva who lives in the Devaloka. Brahma Sahampati is a deva who lives in the Jhana realms. So he's a very pure kind of being. And there are suttas elsewhere which also talk about him. And he seems to have been a stream enter, somebody who actually knew the Dhamma, because he seems to have practiced the Dhamma under the previous Buddha Kassapa. And that is, I take it, that is why he's able here to recognize the Buddha as awakened, because he has himself a stream winner, because he has heard the Dhamma before from a previous Buddha. He sees the Buddha, he recognizes him as awakened, and that's why he goes to him and says, please teach the Dhamma, because he has seen it as it actually is. So that sort of connects that together. Otherwise, you might wonder, how does this Brahma actually know that the Buddha is awakened? One of the epithets here of the Buddha is the deathless one. Now, in what sense is the Buddha deathless? And I think maybe the most important way that he is deathless is because he doesn't have any karmic debt to pay off in the future. He's not going to be reborn again. He doesn't have any future life where he has any debt that he has to pay off. I think that is probably the most important way in which he's deathless. But there's also another interesting thing that you find in the suttas. They talk about a monk, a bhikkhu, or a bhikkhuni having a debt. And they say that as long as you haven't attained arahantship, because you are living off the alms of the lay community that's supporting you, as long as you haven't become an arahant, or at least an arya, you have a debt still to pay off. And only when you become fully enlightened have you paid off that debt to the community who support you 100%. So this is like a way of spurring on the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in fulfilling that, you know, the practice of the Buddha. So in both these senses, of course, the Buddha is debtless. Makes sense to everybody? Everybody happy with that? Yeah? Okay. So then, we move on. Then the Buddha says, "Then I listened to the Brahma's pleading, and out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelt seeing fear and blame and in the other world. Just as in a pond of blue, red, and white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it, and some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rest on the water's surface, and some other lotuses that are born and grow in water rise out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it, so too, surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes, with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelt seeing fear and blame, and in the fear and blame and in the other world." So here we have the Buddha. He has listened to Brahma, and then after listening to the Brahma Sahampati, of course, then he wants to find out for himself whether there actually is any point in teaching these beings. Brahma Sahampati claims here that there are people who will understand. And the Buddha does survey the world with what is called the eye of a Buddha here. And this basically means, like, you know, some kind of supernormal ability to understand the minds of beings, so that you can actually find out whether there is anybody out there who has the ability to understand this. And you see here that he sees beings with much dust and little dust in the eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties. Now, faculties here mean like spiritual faculties, and these are like the five, mostly the five spiritual faculties that we talk about in Buddhism: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So this is what he means here. So somebody who has good mindfulness, good energy, good samadhi, good concentration, this is somebody with keen faculties. And somebody with the opposite is somebody with dull faculties. With good qualities and bad qualities, this again probably refers to the amount of defilements in your mind. How much defilements have you got? And whether you act or don't act on those defilements. In other words, are you being virtuous or not? Easy to teach and hard to teach. You can probably imagine for yourself what that means. It means somebody who, probably somebody who has very strong view, and cleaving to that wrong view, the more strongly you cleave to a wrong view, obviously more difficult it is going to be to teach you. And presumably it also means just to maybe a general sense of stubbornness, perhaps. And then we have the last one here, which is interesting. "And some who dwelt seeing fear in blame and in the other world." Now, the point here is that he obviously understands that there are some people who actually see the danger in rebirth, see the danger in having a, you know, a future life. Because in these scriptures, in the other world is always a reference to the future life after this one. So in other words, there are beings out there who already understand that rebirth is not something desirable. It's something that is scary, because you never know what's going to happen next if you keep on getting reborn. And that's why it is frightening. So because of that, he understands that there are certain people out there who are already very close to penetrating these teachings, because they understand the danger in these particular things. And you see here the simile of the lotuses. And some of them are standing in the water, and they live in the water. Some are on the surface, some are above the surface. And the meaning of this is simply that if you are in the water, it's like being immersed in the world. You are immersed in craving, immersed in sensuality, immersed in possessions, immersed in all these kind of things. And standing above the water, the highest kind of standing above the water is the kind of standing that the Buddha does, where he has no defilements, no connection to the world anymore. He's still in the world, but mentally he's above and beyond the world. And that is like standing above the water, but you are no longer sullied by the water. You're no longer wetted by the water because you are free of attachments for the world. So that is essentially that simile. It's quite a common simile in the suttas. Now, one of the interesting things here, which I perhaps should mention as well, is that you have to remember that the audience here who hear these kind of suttas, many of these would be the Hindus and maybe the Brahmins of that time. So what these Brahmins and Hindus are hearing at that time, they are hearing that Brahma, that Brahma is their god, right? So Brahma is coming to the Buddha and saying to the Buddha, oh please, you know, with one shoulder, robe over one shoulder, with hands in Anjali, and saying, please teach the Dhamma, because there are people in the world who will perish if they don't hear this. So what people are hearing here is that their god, their supreme deity, is coming to essentially pay respects to the Buddha and acknowledge the Buddha as his teacher. So there is a kind of an undertone here of, it's almost like a kind of a statement of saying that Buddhism is superior to the religions of the time, particularly the Brahmanical or Hindu religion that existed in those days. So there are some people that pointed out that this is like this part here of the sutta is almost like it's like a way of basically saying that we are superior, the others are inferior. And so it's a way of turning around, in a sense, the perceptions of the people at that time. And that, of course, leads one to question whether how authentic it is and whether it actually was there from the very beginning, because it sounds like almost like some kind of marketing device here. So anyway, I'll come back to that in a second. So then, having said that, having seen that all this are people with all kinds of faculties, then the Buddha realizes that it is worthwhile to teach, because there will be those who see. And then he says, then I replied to the Brahma Sahampati in stanzas, open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. Thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not speak the Dhamma subtle and sublime. Then the Brahma Sahampati thought, I have created the opportunity for the Blessed One to teach the Dhamma, and after paying homage to me, keeping me on the right, he thereupon departed at once. So that is the intercession here of Brahma, how Brahma sort of turns the Buddha around and says, please teach the Dhamma. And of course the question arises, did this actually happen? Is this historical? Was there such a being as Brahma coming down and asking the Buddha to teach? And it's a very good question because, you know, with our modern sensibilities, you might question whether this sort of things actually can happen. And I think theoretically, from a Buddhist point of view, it might be possible. But still, the question arises, did it actually happen? And to find out such things, whether it is authentic or not, what you have to do, of course, you have to go back to comparative studies of these suttas. And what you find is that in the Chinese parallel, this particular sutta, you find that this paragraph does not exist. So everything that I've read today, from the moment he said, I consider this Dhamma is hard and deep to understand, people might not understand me, all the way till Brahma Sahampati pleading and then leaving, all that is not found in the Madhyama Agama version of the sutta. So it is possible that this particular section is a later addition, that was not originally part of the sutta. It is certain, I don't want to say either way, there's not really any point in making any final decision on these things, but it is possible that that might be the case. On the other hand, and this is maybe the reason why it might be true, and this is an argument that Ajahn Brahm uses, and that is that when you reach this kind of awakening, obviously your mind is extraordinarily peaceful. You have found something which is extremely profound. There's no more defilements in the mind. There's nothing really to drive you forward to do this or that. And because of that extreme sense of peace, and because you have found the solution to the problem that you were trying to find the solution to, there's nothing really more for you to be done. Because of that, there needs to be an external stimulus to actually get you going on the teaching path. And that here in this sutta, you can maybe argue that Brahma Sahampadi is like a mythological stimulus that comes from the outside and says, please teach, because there are beings who will benefit from that teaching. And that stimulus then awakens the compassion in the Buddha, and then he sets out. And I think that is an interesting point, that it may actually be necessary for the Buddha to receive some kind of external stimulus to be able to teach, because otherwise he has found the solution to his problem. He is so peaceful. There's no natural drive inside of him that might drive him forward unless he gets that. Now, whether that external stimulus comes from a Brahma, or whether it comes from another human being, or it comes from anything else, that seems to be unimportant, as long as that stimulus is there. Anyway, that's just a little bit for you to think about. I don't really want to make any final decisions as to whether what is going on here, because it's very hard to know sometimes. There are interesting points to keep in mind. Yes? Sure, it is true. It actually does exist in many different suttas. It's a very common thing here. But the very fact that it's missing from one begs the question, well, why is it missing from one? I don't know. It's very hard to say why. It could be many reasons. But one possibility, at least, is that it wasn't there originally here. That's one possibility here. But you're right. It is a very, very common thing here. Eddie here. The point about, I don't want to go too much into that because it gets a bit complicated, but the point is that the Chinese suttas are very extensive, and they also have the original suttas are called the agamas in the Chinese. So there is a small subsection of the Chinese suttas which are equivalent to the Nikayas, roughly. Not exactly, but roughly. So, yes. 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 Yeah. Well, the problem is that, there is no... The thing about this is that there is... The Chinese also, because it also comes from India originally, that is also basically something which should have been pure and should have been preserved properly. Yeah, but you have to make a distinction here between the different types of suttas. Because in the Chinese, you find the Mahayana suttas on the one hand, you find the agamas, which are equivalent to the Nikayas on the other hand. And these are very distinct, and there is very little reason to think that there has been an influence from one to the other one. And because of that, it's actually one of the amazing things that you will see when you start reading the agamas. They're very, very similar to the Nipali Nikayas. They're almost exactly the same. And that is one of the reasons for why we can have such incredible confidence that the suttas that we have now are the word of the Buddha. Because if the Chinese suttas and the Pali suttas are still the same after 2,200 years or whatever apart, that's astounding. They have been kept almost exactly the same after 2,200 years. That is why we know that these suttas are basically the word of the Buddha. But there are small differences, and one of those small differences is, such a thing as whether Brahma Sahampati came down and asked the Buddha. The point is that it doesn't really make much difference for the Dhamma whether Brahma Sahampati came or not. It doesn't really matter. It's not an important issue. The reason I like to bring it up is simply that there is a distinction here, and it is acceptable to ask the question, did he actually come down and ask the Buddha? It's not something that we have to be feel embarrassed about asking. Oh, I'm a good Buddhist, I must believe this. It doesn't work like that. You're allowed to ask these kind of questions in Buddhism. Yeah. Yeah, but this kind, you know, the thing about whether Brahma Sahampati came and see the Buddha, you probably would never know through any kind of, I think this kind of, there are certain truths that you won't even see then. There are certain truths which are beyond even that kind of knowledge. Yeah. So anyway, okay. Yes, Eddie? Yeah. It's very hard to, it's difficult because, you know, the Chinese, the suttas in Chinese, they were basically, translated into Chinese over a long period of time, starting from all of the first century AD, up until about roughly year 800-900. So it was a very, very long period of time. And many of those suttas are probably very likely to have been as authentic as the Pali. I think overall, the Pali is probably better preserved overall. I think so. That's my personal opinion. But it's still very useful to have that comparison between the two because it actually helps you to, sometimes you find strange things in the Pali suttas and you find a very good correction from the Chinese and you think, wow, this is very interesting. There's something to be learned here from another recension of the suttas. You also have Sanskrit recension of the suttas. You have recensions in many other languages as well. But let's not get too carried away by that. Let's come back to the sutta, because otherwise it's going to take too long, I think. Yeah. That's another discussion we can have some other time, maybe. Yeah. Okay, so then that concludes the chapter with Brahma Sahampati. Yeah. And then the Buddha has decided at this point that he's going to teach. And he continues as follows. I considered thus, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Alara Kalama is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Alara Kalama. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. And the knowledge and vision arose in me. Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. I thought, Alara Kalama's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. So remember that Alara Kalama, he was one of the teachers of the Buddha before his enlightenment. So he then, interesting here, the Buddha thinks back to his teachers, because he knew that they were quite highly developed, and also presumably because of a sense of gratitude towards his teachers. And then he thinks the same for his second teacher. I considered thus, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Uddaka Ramaputta is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Uddaka Ramaputta. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Uddaka Ramaputta died last night. And the knowledge and vision arose in me, Uddaka Ramaputta died last night. I thought, Uddaka Ramaputta's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. I considered thus, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, the bhikkhus of the group of five who attended upon me while I was engaged in my striving were very helpful. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to them. Then I thought, where are the bhikkhus of the group of five now living? And with a divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw that they were living in Benares, in the deer park at Isipatana. So again, you can see here even the Buddha has a sense of gratitude here. He says that they were very helpful to me. And because the group of five were very helpful, that is why he decides to teach them first. And this, of course, is one of the qualities of somebody who is highly developed. They will have a sense of gratitude. So that is that. And now, of course, the Buddha then decides that to go to Benares, and this is the next part of the story here, is how the Buddha travels to Benares to teach the group of five monks. Then, bhikkhus, when I had stayed at Uruvela as long as I chose, I set out to wander by stages to Benares. Between Gaya and the place of enlightenment, the Ajivaka Upaka saw me on the road and said, "Friend, your faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. Under whom have you gone forth, friend? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you proclaim?" And I replied to the Ajivaka Upaka in stanzas. So this is one of the standard ways of describing somebody who has had a deep insight or deep samadhi, is that their faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. And again, faculties are clear basically means here that they have good spiritual faculties such as mindfulness and concentration and wisdom. But I think it also here means that this fact that your concentration and your mindfulness and your purity is so strong that it actually shows through in your deportment, in who you are, you know, in your skin color, it says here, also maybe in the way you look, your eyes, your facial expressions, all these things reflect that inner purity that you have. So it's a double thing there. Your external appearance reflects your inner purity. And then he says to this Ajivaka Upaka, "I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all, by cravings ceasing freed, having known this all for myself, to whom should I point as teacher? I have no teacher, and one like me exists nowhere in all the world, with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. I am the accomplished one in the world, the teacher supreme. I alone am fully the fully enlightened one, whose fires are quenched and extinguished. I go now to the city of Kasi to set in motion the wheel of Dhamma. In a world that has become blind, I go to beat the drum of the deathless." So you see here just a couple of things maybe I can just mention here. Whose fires are quenched and extinguished. Well, the fires in Buddhism are the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. They are fires because they might make your mind very unsturdy and very wobbly and very disturbed in a way. So they are fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. And he has quenched those fires. He has no more defilements at all. I go to the city of Kasi. Kasi is another name for Benares. To set in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And to beat the drum of the deathless. In other words, to teach the Dhamma. That's what it basically means. And then this Upaka replies, "By your claims, friend, you ought to be the universal victor." And the Buddha replies, "The victors are those like me who have won the destruction of taints. I have vanquished all evil or all bad states. Therefore, Upaka, I am a victor." When this was said, the Ajivaka Upaka said, "May it be so, friend." Shaking his head, he took a bypath and departed. He doesn't seem to have been too impressed. So the point here is that this Ajivaka, he says, he talks about a universal victor, which presumably has a special meaning in the Ajivaka teaching. The Ajivaka is a particular sect that exists at that time. And presumably they had a teaching about some universal victor. And then the Buddha rephrases that, and he says that, well, I am a victor, but perhaps not in the way that you mean a victor. The reason I'm a victor is because I have vanquished all bad states. That's what he says there. I've destroyed the taints. That's why I am a victor. So he reinterprets the Upaka statement in a Buddhist kind of context, in a Buddhist sense. And in that sense, he is a victor. And when this was said, Upaka was not impressed, so he's shaking his head, took a bypath and departed. Now the word for bypath here in the Pali is umagga, and this word umagga has like a double meaning. It means both the wrong way or a different way. It means both a different way and a wrong way. So the point here is that he went off in a different direction. He wasn't going to follow the Buddha, obviously. But also the point is that he didn't understand the Buddha's teachings. So he went the wrong way, not the way of the Dhamma, not following the Eightfold Path. So it has that double meaning there, that he both physically and mentally went in the wrong direction, so to speak. And this, I think you find it quite fascinating here, because here you find somebody who is face to face with the Buddha, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, the supreme being in the world. And even though they're actually face to face with the Buddha, they fail to recognize that this is somebody exceptional. He sees that there's something exceptional there, because he sees that his faculties are clear. But he doesn't really grasp the extent to which the Buddha is exceptional. And to so much so that he just goes off and shakes his head. And I think about you when you go around these days, you hear many people always saying that, oh, I'm going to wait till the Buddha Maitreya comes around because I want a proper teacher. You know, these days Buddhism is so defunct and so corrupt, there's nothing left in Buddhism. So I'm going to wait till the real deal, so to speak, comes back again, who knows when. But the point is that, you know, you might meet the Buddha in a future life sometime, and you might be like Upaka. You might look at him and say, oh yeah, sure, and then walk off in a different direction. The point is, you just don't know whether you will be able to recognize the Buddha. You know, it takes a lot of spiritual maturity. It takes a lot of understanding to be able to recognize this Buddha. So don't. I find here that this here is a great example for showing us that we shouldn't think that we shouldn't actually postpone these things. We shouldn't postpone practicing the Dhamma into some kind of hypothetical future time when you might meet the Buddha, because you have no idea of the circumstances at that time. What actually will happen? You might not recognize him. You might have some kind of view about some kind of creator god which blocks you. You might be reborn in a realm where you have no chance to hear this Buddha. There's so many potentials for blocking you that putting off the Dhamma to a future Buddha is, as far as I'm concerned, it's a very, very foolish thing to do. Now is the chance, opportunity is here now. This is the time to do it, not a future, hypothetical, legendary, mythical time, which nobody knows about when it's going to be, or even if it's going to be quite frank. Yeah. So that is what happened to the Ajivaka Upaka. Then the Buddha goes on. Then bhikkhus, wandering by stages, I eventually came to Benares, the deer park at Isipatana, and I approached the bhikkhus of the group of five. The bhikkhus saw me coming in the distance, and they agreed among themselves thus, "Friends, here comes the recluse Gotama, who lives luxuriously, who gave up his striving and reverted to luxury. We should not pay homage to him or rise up for him, or receive his ball and outer robe, but a seat may be prepared for him. If he likes, he may sit down. However, as I approached, those bhikkhus found themselves unable to keep their pact. One came to meet me and took my ball and outer robe, another prepared a seat, and another set out water for my feet. However, they addressed me by name and as friend." So in other words, they addressed him as an equal rather than as somebody superior. "Thereupon I told them, 'Bhikkhus, do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend. The Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Listen, bhikkhus, the deathless, or really the freedom from death, has been attained. I shall instruct you, I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed, by realizing for yourself here and now through direct knowledge, you will soon enter upon and abide in that same supreme goal of the holy life for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness.' When this was said, the bhikkhus of the group of five answered me thus, 'Friend Gotama, by the conduct, the practice and the performance of austerities that you undertook, you did not achieve any superhuman state, and it is a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Since you now live luxuriously, having given up your striving and reverted to luxury, How will you have achieved any superhuman state, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? When this was said, I told them that Tathagata does not live luxuriously, nor has he given up his striving and reverted to luxury. The Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Listen, bhikkhus, the freedom from death has been attained, etc., etc. And that freedom from death is what people of good families go forth from the home life into homelessness for. So you can see here that what is happening here is that the group of five, they are saying because the Buddha gave up the austerities, they are saying that he has reverted to luxury. Because this was the prevalent view at the time of the Buddha, that either you practice austerities or you weren't really a good ascetic, you weren't really a good monk. That was the way things were done in those days. And that is why, one reason why the Buddhist path is so revolutionary, because it says that these austerities don't actually lead to awakening. What you have to find instead is the middle way, the one which is neither luxury nor austerities, but where you are at ease and you feel relaxed, and you can actually, that's when you can get into deep states of samadhi. Not when you torture yourself, nor when you indulge yourself, but that beautiful middle way just in between. So the Buddha is saying here, well, actually, no, I haven't reverted to luxury at all. It's just that I have given up the austerities. I found the middle way. And now you can see why the first sermon of the Buddha, I don't like the word sermon, the first teaching of the Buddha was the teaching of the middle way. Because here they are telling him, you have reverted to luxury, given up austerities, and that's why the Buddha responded in his first teaching. We're teaching about the middle way. So that's why the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is traditionally called the first sutta of the Buddha, and I think it's quite likely to have been the first sutta, that's why it starts off with teaching the middle way, because he's responding here to a misapprehension that was very common at that time in India. So then the Buddha goes on. A second time, the bhikkhus of the group of five said to me, "Friend Gotama," and they said exactly the same thing, "how can you achieve any superhuman state, in other words, enlightenment or whatever, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones?" And the second time, the Buddha says the same thing, "I have not reverted to luxury." A third time, the same thing happens. And then the Buddha says, when this was said, I asked them, "Bhikkhus, have you ever known me to speak like this before?" "No, venerable sir." "Bhikkhus, the Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Listen, bhikkhus, the freedom from death has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed. By realizing for yourself here and now, through direct knowledge, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness." And the Buddha says, "I was able to convince the bhikkhus of the group of five. Then I sometimes instructed two bhikkhus while the other three went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those three bhikkhus brought back from the alms round. Sometimes I instructed three bhikkhus while the other two went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those two bhikkhus brought back from the alms round. Then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and thus instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the freedom from birth, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, attained the freedom from birth, the supreme security of bondage, extinguishment, being themselves subject to old age." Old age is the correct translation here, not aging. "Being themselves subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeking the freedom from old age, the freedom from sickness, the freedom from death, the freedom from sorrow, the freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, they attained that freedom from old age, freedom from illness, freedom from death, freedom from sorrow, freedom from defilement, the security from bondage, nibbana, extinguishment. The knowledge and vision arose in them. Our deliverance is unshakable. This is our last birth. There is no more renewal of being. So there you have the five ascetics, the five monks who looked after the Buddha, also finding the same enlightenment, the same awakening, the same nibbana that the Buddha himself found. And I will make a point that I made last time, and that is, you heard me now just translating this, instead of translating it as the unborn, the unaging, the deathless, the sorrowless, etc., actually, the way the Pali is used here, I say the meaning here is not so much the deathless, which sounds like some kind of state, but actually it means a freedom from death. Because what they were seeking, they realized that death was a problem, so what they were seeking was a freedom from death. They weren't seeking some kind of state, they were seeking the solution to a problem. And that is even more clear earlier on, because before the Buddha's enlightenment, he realized the problem was death, and then he, of course, went out to seek freedom from that problem. So as far as I'm concerned, that is actually a better translation here, freedom from these things. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah, you can also call it freedom from death. That amounts to the same thing, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. Freedom from death amounts to the same thing, right? Yeah. My point is just that if you call it the deathless, you're actually making it into some kind of state, some kind of being. It sounds like you can continue to live almost. So I prefer the idea of freedom from death. It gives the same feeling. Freedom from death means that you're not going to die, right? Same thing. But it doesn't have the same emphasis of a state of something solid being there. Remember that the Buddha's teaching is only about ending suffering, right? It's not about attaining any kind of state or anything like that. So nibbana is the ending of suffering. That's what the Buddha's teaching is all about. So because of that, it's you don't need to worry about what happens. What all you need to worry about is making an end of suffering. That's the purpose here. That's why I don't like these ideas of states, because they can't easily be misunderstood. Yeah. Okay. So then they realized that they had no more rebirth in the future, that the deliverance was unshakable. In other words, unshakable means there is no returning anymore to the previous state. It is solid, unmovable. So that is basically the biography of the Buddha in this sutta. And the last part here is like an addition to the sutta. And I will go through this quite quickly because it doesn't really have so much to do with the Buddha's life, which is the main purpose of the sutta. There has been some suggestions that this particular part here actually belongs earlier on in the sutta. Because the next thing the Buddha says here, he talks about the five cords of sensual pleasure. In other words, talks about the danger in sensuality. And if this teaching is given to the same five monks, it is a little bit late because now they're already arahants. No need to teach them about these things anymore. So some people have suggested that it is maybe out of place, or it could be that now we are back to the very beginning of the sutta, where the Buddha is actually teaching a group of monks at the Ramaka's hermitage. And that we're back to that very beginning again, that he's now finished with his life story, and he's now teaching the monks again. So I'll go through this fairly briefly and make a very few comments as I go along. Because there are these five cords of sensual pleasure. What are the five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire, provocative of lust. These are the five cords of sensual pleasure. As to those recluses and Brahmins who are tied to these five cords of sensual pleasure, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, and who use them without seeing the danger in them and understanding the escape from them, it may be understood of them. They have met with calamity, met with disaster. The evil one, this is Mara, the evil one may do with them as he likes. Suppose a forest deer who was bound lay down on a heap of snares. It might be understood of him, he has met with calamity, met with disaster. The hunter can do with him as he likes. And when the hunter comes, he cannot go where he wants, because he's tied down, right? So too, as to those recluses and Brahmins who are tied to the five cords of sensual pleasure, it may be understood of them. They have met with calamity, met with disaster. The evil one, Mara, may do with them as he likes. As to those recluses and Brahmins who are not tied to the five cords of sensual pleasures, who are not infatuated with them or utterly committed to them, and who use them seeing the danger in them, understanding the escape from them, it may be understood of them. They have not met with calamity, not met with disaster. The evil one cannot do with them as he likes. Suppose a forest deer who was unbound lay down on a heap of snares. It might be understood of him. He has not met with calamity, not met with disaster. The hunter cannot do with him as he likes. And when the hunter comes, he can go where he wants. So too, as to those recluses and Brahmins who are not tied to the five cords of sensual pleasure, it may be understood of them. They have not met with calamity, not met with disaster. The evil one cannot do with them as he likes. Suppose a forester is wandering in the forest wilds. He walks confidently, stands confidently, sits confidently, lies down confidently. Why is that? Because he is out of the hunter's range. So too, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. So you see here three kinds of people, or three kinds of monks, or anybody else for that matter. And the first one is the one that is infatuated with sensual pleasures. That is just somebody, an ordinary person in the world, indulging themselves with sensual pleasures. And they basically are being led by the nose and are being held by Mara. Mara can control them. Whenever Mara sort of sets up a nice sight or nice thing, you are led by the nose and Mara can make you go and do whatever he wants, essentially. Now, the second person here, these are, I would take the people who have a sense of sense restraint. They restrain themselves. They don't allow themselves to be led around by sensual pleasures wherever they go. They restrain themselves and hold back. So even though they are lying down on the snares, as soon as Mara comes to control them, they restrain themselves and walk off wherever they want. And then there is the last category here, and these are the people that practice the jhanas and even higher attainments. They are completely outside the range of Mara. Because when you come to these deep stages of samadhi, you have to leave sensuality completely behind. So completely behind that you actually cannot be attracted to these things after these states of samadhi anymore. And that's why it says that Mara has been blindfolded. Mara cannot see these people. In a sense, you can see here that when you attain like a jhana state, it is such a high state that anybody on a sensual plane is not able to understand somebody who has attained a jhana state. Somebody who has attained a jhana state can understand the lower beings in a sensual realm, but not the other way around. The point is, you cannot understand these states unless you have actually experienced them yourself. And that's why Mara is blindfolded, because Mara does not understand the object or the consciousness or the mind of the being who attains these particular states. Mara is no longer able to lead them around by the nose through sensuality. So that is what is happening here in brief. And the same then is true for all the other jhanas and the immaterial attainments. So again, with the stilling of a blind thought, etc., he enters and abides in the second jhana. And again, Mara is blindfolded. With the fading away as well as rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity, enters and abides in the third jhana. And again, Mara is blindfolded. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana. And again, Mara is blindfolded. Again, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, perceiving or aware that space is infinite, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinity of space. This bhikkhu is again said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, by surmounting that base of infinity of space, he abides or is aware that consciousness is infinite, and a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of the infinity of consciousness. And again, it blindfolds Mara. Again, by completely surmounting the base of the infinity of consciousness, aware that there is nothing, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. And again, the bhikkhu has blindfolded Mara. Again, by completely surmounting the base of nothingness, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. So these are the eight attainments of samadhi, the four jhanas and the four immaterial attainments. Just very briefly here, I'd just like to point out that you have the first immaterial attainment, aware that space is infinite. Now, it's important to be clear here what this actually means. It means that it doesn't mean that you are seeing something infinite. That's impossible, to see something infinite. What it means is that you're seeing something which has no boundaries. You're seeing space without boundaries. That's what you're seeing here. You're not actually seeing something which goes on forever. You're seeing infinite in the sense of not finite, lacking in boundaries. And the same is true with consciousness. You're not seeing consciousness which goes on forever. You're seeing consciousness without boundaries, without anything finite. So, and the base of the infinity of space just means that attainment, basically, and also the corresponding rebirth. It's like the realm, if you like, or the realm, perhaps, of the infinity of space. And then we come to the very end of the sutta. Again, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. And his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of his opportunity, and to have crossed beyond attachment to the world. He walks confidently, stands confidently, sits confidently, lies down confidently. Why is that? Because he is out of the evil one's range. So this is what the Buddha said before about the deer that walks confidently, stands confidently, because it's outside of the hunter's range. Now, the monk or the bhikkhuni or whoever become an arahat, you're no longer able to be led around by Mara. You're no longer able to be led by the nose. So you are confident and you have a sense of self-determination. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that is the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. Any questions before we call it a day? Yes, Ainsley. Yeah. There is such a concept in Theravada literature, in the suttas. Yeah, and there must be in Mahayana as well, because it's a universal concept that is across all Buddhist. I think they do, because the point is that it is missing in this sutta, but there are other suttas in the Agamas which actually do have the Brahma Sampati coming down and asking the Buddha. So it's there, just not in this particular sutta. It's actually quite a prevalent thing, this idea of Brahma Sampati coming down and asking the Buddha. It occurs in a number of Pali as well. So it's basically it's quite a common theme. But it's still interesting, even though it is very common and it's there. I find it still interesting to ask the question, well, was it there originally, or is it like something which came later on? The fact that it's missing in one place is enough to give you a little bit of doubt and to sort of wonder, why is it missing here? What's the reason? And there could be many reasons. But yes, Pacheka Buddhas exist everywhere across the range. So, yeah. Anybody else? Yes. Sorry, can I say that again, please? Balance the five faculties. Well, the interesting thing is that the suttas don't actually have all that much about balancing the faculties. The idea of balancing the faculties is something that you find later on in the Pali literature. You find it in the commentaries, in the Visuddhimagga, I think, in other places. But not so much in the suttas. And I think you have to be careful with the sort of idea of balancing the faculties, because sometimes, if you think of the word balance, it means one thing arising, another one coming down. People might say, oh, I've got too much samadhi and too little energy, so I better do a little bit less samadhi and do more energy. But that is where you can go wrong, because you cannot really have too much samadhi. It's really, what you have to do then is balance it by having more energy instead, not by reducing your samadhi. So, and the same thing goes for wisdom and faith. You cannot have too much wisdom and too little faith. If you have real wisdom, not just intellectual understanding, but real wisdom, it cannot be too much. And the same thing with faith. If you have real faith, wholesome faith, it cannot be too much. So what you do if you have a lot of faith, well, you just concentrate on developing your wisdom instead. So you raise up the other aspect of that pair instead of trying to find a balance which might indicate reducing one and increasing the other. So that doesn't actually say anywhere in the suttas that you should balance these things. All it says is that you should make sure that you have a balance between the faculties. And the famous suttas, most famous sutta which talks about this sort of thing is the Sona Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 6s, where you have the famous sutta about Sona who walks walking meditation so much, got so much energy, that he starts bleeding from his feet. He had this very kind of nice upbringing with a wealthy family. He never had to do much hard work. So his sole of his feet are supposed to be very, very soft. According to the commentary, he has little hairs growing in the sole of his feet. If you look at your own soles, it probably doesn't have that. It's pretty unusual. So he was so delicately nurtured that he started bleeding because he was expending too much energy. So the Buddha went to him and said, well, find that balance. Don't exert. You find that balance in the, he doesn't say balance between the faculties, he says the balance of the faculties in a more broad sense, that you actually do all the faculties in an appropriate manner, not one against the other, but a sense of balance in your practice as a whole. That is the only place where the suttas talk about something like that. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the most important thing, I think, in life is to work on the hindrance of ill will and anger. That's the most important one, because that is by far the most destructive one. So work on that one first. Don't worry so much about sensual desire, because I mean, you know, if you live lay life, basically you are choosing to have some, you know, some enjoyment in the sensual realm, and that's okay. Don't feel bad about that, because that only drags you down, makes you feel worse. But work instead on the other side of the thing, which is the anger and the ill will. That is very destructive. That is destructive in your interpersonal relationships. It's destructive in the sense of making bad karma for the future. It's destructive in breaking your precepts and all these kind of things. Yeah. Asavas. Yeah, well, asavas is, well, the karma asava, bhava asava, and avijja asava. Sorry? No, it's not. It doesn't work like that. You know, it's your karma is one thing, but what you want to do, what you do in this life, is something else. So whatever your karma is like, you can still do things. Karma doesn't block you from doing what is right and doing what is good. It just can make it more difficult sometimes. But if you are determined and you want to live the right way, you know, you start off by keeping the five precepts. Then you continue by purifying your mind of anger and ill will. Do loving kindness meditation. One of the most powerful things to do to get rid of these things. So that is what you should be doing. I mean, you know, you have to start with the course of defilement first of all. If you get to the point where you find out you have very little anger, that you're a very good-hearted person, always kind and compassionate to people, maybe not always, but, you know, by far the most of the time, and on occasion they get angry, then you can start worrying about desire more at that point. But the anger, ill will, is by far the most destructive force in human beings. So keep, you know, certainly don't breach the five precepts. Don't do things in the sensual realm, you know, with desires that breaches the five precepts. Of course, don't do that. You know, keep it within those limits. But don't be too concerned about that. Anger is by far the most important one. Eddie here. Okay. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi once said that there seems to be a dual thing in the suttas. There is, on the one hand, Mara is like a psychological force. You know, it's the desire, whatever comes up in the mind, and you sort of follow after things, you know, like being led by the nose because of desires. But it seems that in the suttas, it seems that Mara also actually is a being. You know, it's a being that exists in a particular realm. And it is very powerful. Very powerful being, yeah, in a very high realm. Seems to be two things there, yeah. But of course, the most important one is the psychological Mara, the one which drives you around. That's the one you have to deal with. Yeah. Okay, everybody happy? Yeah. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.